From the state capitol, the Florida Public Radio Network brings you Capitol Report.
The Florida Senate is taking its time to come up with a state spending plan while the House pushes ahead.
The tact that I take as president and prior to that was always been kind of a slow and steady, take as much information as you can. So we're still a few weeks away from allocations.
A House committee approves a plan for new political districts pitting incumbents against each other.
It's going to be very ugly on both sides of the aisle. Friendships will end, tears will have to be dried, teeth will gnash. It's not going to be a good couple months for some folks.
Lawmakers tackle a new abortion bill with the focus on the race and gender of the fetus. And legislators look at new traffic laws for cars that drive themselves. I'm Tramell Gomes, and that's all coming up on Capitol Report. The state budget is one of two bills Florida lawmakers have to pass this session. And an early start to the legislative session means the revenue picture is still unclear. One chamber wants to wait for it to come into focus. But as Lynn Hatter reports, the other is on the verge of voting on a spending plan and taking an early claim to how funding for the state's many services will be distributed.
Members, today we're going to have a discussion about the 2012-2013 budget.
In a Senate Education Budget Committee, lawmakers are going through the budget line by line. The Senate doesn't have a proposal of its own, so it's looking at one crafted by Governor Rick Scott and a preliminary draft by the House, which has already completed its spending plan for the upcoming fiscal year. Governor Rick Scott has called for a $1 billion increase to education. The House has put that number at $1.1 billion. But the Senate's chief education budget writer, David Simmons, a Maitland Republican, wants to top that number.
And so in order to get the level funding with last year, the House number is approximately $300 million off. The governor's proposal is approximately $320 million off. And so the question is what will the Senate do with respect to that approximate $300 million?
If the Senate goes along with Simmons's plan, it would restore most of the money lawmakers cut from education last session. There's just one problem. At this point, for the Senate, it's all hypothetical. Lawmakers in that chamber haven't even started writing a proposal, and when they'll start is still up in the air.
The schedule that I'm following now, we have not put out allocations, and for a simple reason. I still want more information from the individual budget chairs before I tell them what they can or can't spend.
Senate President Mike Haridopoulos says he's still not comfortable with revenue estimates projecting a $1.4 billion gap lawmakers have to fill, and he wants to wait and see if newer projections paint a different picture.
And I think I brought the Wall Street Journal in the other day, and I said, look, anyone who says this is a stable economy isn't reading your newspapers. I mean, it's still a very difficult time, and I think the tact that I've taken as president and prior to that was always been kind of a slow and steady, take as much information as you can. So we're still a few weeks away from allocations.
Slow and steady, just like the fable of the tortoise and the hare. It's a story that's playing out in the Florida legislature as the Senate, the tortoise, plods along, while the hare, the House, pushes forward with a budget proposal that's similar to what the governor has proposed, with a little extra money for education and a little less for health and human services. But the House isn't going as far as the governor's recommended $2 billion cut to health care. Representative Matt Hudson is the chairman of that committee, and he's taken another approach.
Overall, I think there's a overall spend about 1% less than last year, but that includes when you add in the Medicaid workload adjustments, the kid care workload adjustments that obviously are, you know, we're budgeting for that future increase. And so there is a decrease, but overall, I think it's a very modest increase, and it does do a excellent job of ensuring that our seniors are taken care of.
The governor's 15% hospital rate reduction is slimmed down to 7 in the House proposal, and nursing homes lose only about 2.5%. Adults on Medicaid would also lose some services, but the Agency for Persons with Disabilities would get extra money to help with their ongoing budget problems. Transportation, general government, and the environment would all take cuts. Speaker Dean Cannon says all House budget committees have finished writing their proposals and a floor vote is coming soon. He says he's not too concerned about the Senate's slow and steady approach to budgeting.
We've not gotten any formal request to extend session. I think the Senate is the more deliberative chamber. They want to be as deliberative as they see fit. That's their call. We feel like we're doing our job well, and as we told them that, we're ready to talk. The ball's in their court, but we're not even at halftime yet, so I'm not really worried about it yet.
In the fable of the tortoise and the hare, the tortoise won the race. But in Tallahassee, they're still taking bets on what a final budget will look like and if it gets done on time. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
A Florida House committee today approved a redistricting plan criticized by anti-gerrymandering groups. James Call reports the effort to draw new legislative and congressional boundaries took a dramatic turn when Chairman Will Weatherford blasted the critics after they submitted a last-minute alternative proposal and then declined to explain it to the committee.
The League of Women Voters, Common Cause, and the National Council of RAZA backed the anti-gerrymandering fair districts amendment approved by voters in 2010. Thursday afternoon, the coalition delivered a 12-page letter explaining a plan they say better complies with fair districts than the one the committee was preparing to pass. Wesley Chappell, Representative Will Weatherford, introduced the group's proposal. When he called for someone to explain its methodology, no one stepped forward. Weatherford even called out by name League of Women Voters spokesman Ben Wilcox.
I want to just one more time, before I go into the explanation of the map, I know there are members of the representative of the League of Women Voters that are here, Mr. Wilcox, who serves as our lobbyist. Mr. Wilcox, we would love to have you come on and express any of your thoughts on this map. I know y'all worked hard on it. We've had many others express thoughts. And just one more time, we'd love to give you a chance to do that or share any words with the committee. Not prepared to do that? Okay.
Weatherford's explanation was to question the motives of fair district supporters. He started by saying the citizens of Florida deserve better than a letter delivered the night before a scheduled vote.
And frankly, I find it disappointing that anyone would suggest first calling our maps, looking at them in a derogatory manner, saying that they don't follow the letter of the law, and then refusing to stand before us and explain to us how theirs does. And I'm very disappointed by that. But, Mr. Chairman, since we don't have members to speak on that, I think that it's a frankly unfortunate political and more likely probably a legal stunt that this is taken, and I frankly find it offensive.
Before and after the meeting, Wilcox said the group is letting the letter do its talking for now. It explains a nesting concept where House of Representatives seats don't cross Senate district lines. The method produced a map with three House seats in each Senate district. The results are sometimes meandering, raises questions about voting rights compliance, and whether communities of interest remain intact. Broward Representative Evan Jenny, who says he generally supports the League, offers insight into why the group is declining to explain itself publicly. There's probably no more of a political act than the drawing of districts for which politicians will compete to represent. Battle lines are being drawn, and Jenny says the skirmishes will occur in the courtroom.
A lot of these questions, to be completely frank, are going to be answered in depositions. I won't be of any part of it, but there's going to be people suing left and right. And, you know, these questions are going to come out more and more with a whole lot more detail.
And Jenny predicts the battles will be waged on the House floor in neighborhoods across the state. The committee approved a plan for the House that pits 38 incumbents into districts with other legislators. For instance, the proposal places Democrat Jenny in the same district as Hollywood's Joe Gibbons.
It's going to be very ugly on both sides of the aisle. There's going to friendships will end, tears will have to be dried, teeth will gnash. It's not going to be a good couple months for some folks.
Jenny says his friendship with fellow Democrat Joe Gibbons will survive redistricting. That so many incumbents will have to compete against other sitting politicians. Someone explains Weatherford's anger with the criticism that the committee drew a plan protecting sitting politicians and favoring one party over the other. A Herald Times analysis of the plan says the Republican-controlled House's proposal increases the odds of Democrats winning 9 to 11 additional seats.
Based on newspaper articles I've read by your very newspapers, almost a third of the legislators in our chamber are drawn out of their seats.
There's not a single legislature in the history of America that I know without a court order that has drawn that many members out of their seats. We did it because that's what the Constitution said we had to do. There was no politics involved. This was purely something that we felt like we had to do to follow the Constitution. And so that's why the attack on the integrity of the process with that letter was what was most disappointing.
Even with an additional 11 Democratic seats, the balance of power would not change at the Capitol. The GOP would still have a 70-50 advantage in the House, while Democrats hold about a 500,000 edge in voter registration. Weatherford said the plan is to present the proposal to the House Thursday and then send it to the Senate Friday. Then the redistricting maps would head to the Florida Supreme Court for a 30-day review. For Florida Public Radio, I'm James Call.
Still to come on Capitol Report, some lawmakers question the motivation of a bill that would prevent doctors from performing an abortion because of the sex or race of the fetus.
This is perhaps one of the most disingenuous pieces of legislation I've ever seen. I think it games this body.
Emergency room doctors could soon be protected from medical malpractice lawsuits despite objections from opponents.
318 of 8 million admissions is 0.000039. That's not any kind of increased risk.
And Florida lawmakers hope to have new traffic laws in place by the time cars start driving themselves.
The progression of the technology has gone faster than I think we even anticipated when we first started this. So it's the development of the technology is actually accelerating.
Several bills related to the reproductive rights of women are making their way through the Florida House. Regan MacArthur reports one is a resolution attempting to declare this week Reproductive Rights Awareness Week. Three others would put more rules in place for when, where, and why an abortion can be performed.
Florida lawmakers are once again pursuing legislation to put more limitations on the ability of women to terminate their pregnancies. A measure sponsored by Representative Scott Plakin, a Longwood Republican, would make it illegal for a doctor to perform an abortion because of the sex or race of a fetus.
This is more about discrimination than abortion, and that's what I believe. It's surrounded with the abortion process, but it's really about us being consistent in how we enforce discrimination in this country.
Plakin's bill, House Bill 1327, would be named the Susan B. Anthony and Frederick Douglass Prenatal Non-Discrimination and Equal Opportunity for Life Act. Representative Mark Pafford, a Democrat from West Palm Beach, says he finds the bill to be misleading.
I appreciate bills that are just straight up trying to stand in the way of a woman's ability to seek health care. Or get an abortion. I actually appreciate those. This is perhaps one of the most disingenuous pieces of legislation I've ever seen. I think it games this body. I don't frankly appreciate the fact that you say it's about discrimination when in fact the direct impact is on a woman's ability to get health care or get an abortion.
Representative Lori Berman, a Democrat from Delray Beach, echoes that, saying the bill is posing as a defender of gender equality and racial justice.
In fact, it's actually the opposite. It requires intensive scrutiny of the reason for an abortion, and it questions women's decision-making, but it doesn't address the issue of discrimination.
And Berman questions the need for the bill.
There's no empirical evidence that this is happening here in the United States. In fact, when I talked about the numbers, the vast majority of abortions happen even before sex is determined.
But Plakin says a study by the Department of Economics at Columbia University shows it is an issue.
Based on the 2000 census, where they concluded in these ethnic populations that on the third child, here's a fact, and I know facts are difficult sometimes, but that 1.5, there's 1.5 males born to every female. So I don't know how you could be more clear that this is happening at least in this country.
Two other bills discussed would limit the time frame in which an abortion can be performed. Republican Representative Daniel Davis of Jacksonville is pursuing legislation that would prohibit a doctor from performing an abortion if a fetus is more than 20 weeks old.
There's an overwhelming body of evidence that a 5-month post-fertilized unborn baby can feel pain. And it's our compelling state interest to make sure we keep them from suffering.
Davis's bill, House Bill 823, makes exceptions for mothers whose lives would otherwise be threatened, but does not currently make exceptions for instances of rape or incest. Again, Representative Berman raised questions about such a bill. Berman says she worries the bill could force a woman to continue carrying an unviable fetus. She talks about a case in Nebraska where a similar measure is in effect.
There was a 34-year-old woman whose water broke at week 22. Her fetus would not develop lungs and would die at birth. The doctors could not perform an abortion because of this law. She had to give birth to this child and then watch for 15 minutes while the baby died. I don't want that to happen here in Florida.
Several lawmakers also raised concerns about the proposal's constitutionality. A bill brought forward by Riverview Republican Representative Rachel Bergen serves a similar purpose. Bergen's bill, House Bill 277, would prohibit an abortion once the fetus reaches viability, except in special cases, and would require any late-term abortions that are performed to be done in a hospital by a physician with special training. All three bills passed through the House Health and Human Services Access Subcommittee. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
You're listening to Capitol Report on the Florida Public Radio Network. I'm Tramell Gomes. A 2007 Florida Senate report concluded that too many doctors are refusing emergency room on-call duty due to an increased exposure to lawsuits. As Sasha Cordner reports, one lawmaker is hoping to alleviate those concerns by granting emergency room doctors immunity from medical malpractice lawsuits.
Republican Representative Matt Gaetz of Shalimar says it's clear to him that emergency room doctors should be considered agents of this state. He says they provide care to millions of Floridians, sometimes free of charge. So he says it's time for these doctors to have some protections.
House Bill 385 extends the state's sovereign immunity protection to emergency room physicians. It will lower medical malpractice insurance costs, attract more physicians to ER practice, and improve the quality of health care provided in our state.
Under the bill, the person who files a medical malpractice lawsuit against the ER doctor must prove failure to provide a diagnostic test is a violation of the standard of care. House Bill 385 also allows the doctors being sued as well as their legal team to essentially do discovery on the person doing the suing. That would include interviewing the person's other health care providers without the presence of that person or their lawyer. Gaetz called that leveling the playing field. But Dana Brooks with the Florida Justice Association says it would create a, quote, chilling effect.
One's going to want to go to their doctor and share the things they need to share to get the health care they need if they have to worry about that being shared with opposing counsel in a lawsuit one day. No one knows if they're going to be in a medical malpractice lawsuit. So if they have to worry about that being used against them, that's going to be a problem.
Deborah Henley, who's also with the Florida Justice Association, feels there is no need for the bill and cited some figures. They showed 8 million Floridians visited an ER last year. Out of that number, there were only about 300 medical malpractice claims. Henley says, based on those figures, she disagrees that ER doctors face an avalanche of lawsuits.
318 of 8 million admissions is 0.000039. That's not any kind of increased risk. I'd say that is a very low risk of a medical malpractice claim arising out of an emergency room.
But Dr. Andy Borum, a Tallahassee orthopedic surgeon, disagrees. Borum is one of 14 orthopedic physicians that is on call for emergencies from Panama City to Lake City. He says to be on call means shutting down his practice for a full day and a half just so he can deal with ER trauma patients. Borum says he and his medical colleagues deserve sovereign immunity protections.
I will assure you that between 10 p.m. and 7 a.m., most of those people are either drunk and or not insured. And yet I go ahead and set aside all of my revenue-generating portions the following day so that I can be available to take care of those individuals. And all we're asking you is that for those individuals who provide zero revenue and are yet afforded limitless liability, to correct that.
Though most members of the House Judiciary Committee voted in favor of the bill, Democratic Representative Darren Soto of Orlando said he could not support it because the full fiscal impact to the state is unknown.
I know where the doctors are coming from. You know, they're in the ER. They don't want to get sued. But this bill's not going to do that. They're still going to get sued. It's just going to be the state's cost now. The best estimate we have is $34.5 million cost to the state. and we don't even know what the reduction rates are going to be. And for that, I can't vote for this bill.
Lawmakers who supported the bill say they are still concerned about the expansion of sovereign immunity. The bill's sponsor, Representative Gates, says he's willing to work out any of those concerns. The bill has two more committee stops before it heads to the House floor. Its companion, Senate Bill 614, has yet to come through any committees. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
Here's Ronald J. Eben with a look at some of the action around the Capitol on Monday.
Monday at the Capitol is the beginning of Children's Week. The United Way of Florida and partners will be on hand with exhibits and displays. The Senate Criminal Justice Committee meets at 9 to consider a number of bills, including one that deals with sexual predators and the use of the Internet. Another revises the quantity of controlled substance that a person must buy or sell in order to receive a mandatory minimum sentence. The House Health Human Services Committee will take up the issue of concussions in high school and in youth athletic teams. And the House Justice Appropriations Committee will consider a bill that would create a task force on drug abuse and newborns. And that's the daybook for Monday, January 30th.
Finally, there are times when things happen and the Florida legislature has to play catch-up in response. But Tom Flanagan reports there's at least one case in this year's session in which lawmakers are looking years down the road to a time when cars will drive themselves.
Back in the 1960s, George Jetson and other characters in that futuristic cartoon series rode in cars that drove themselves. Now, some 50 years later, that cartoon is becoming reality.
Google, the internet company, has been secretly working on a sophisticated combination of hardware and software that could revolutionize the feasibility of a self-driving car.
And that news report is by no means speculative. Google representative Justin Saffy told members of the Florida House Transportation and Highway Safety Subcommittee that the project is definitely beyond the drawing board stage.
As with all technologies we witness in our daily lives, the progression of the technology has gone faster than I think we even anticipated when we first started this. So it's the development of the technology is actually accelerating.
Google's experimental fleet of self-piloted Priuses has already racked up 140,000 miles of California highway driving. Several car makers are working on their own autonomous vehicles. How soon might self-driving cars be hitting the nation's roads en masse? Saffy says years instead of decades, possibly in the 5 to 10 year time frame. Of course, all motor vehicles, regardless of who or what is doing the driving, must follow highway safety laws when on the highway. So Saffy says one state is gearing up for the future.
The state of Nevada did pass legislation, and they're about to finalize their regulations. The Department of Highway Safety and Motor Vehicles is going to finalize their regulations on February 15th.
There are many unanswered questions when it comes to the robotic rules of the road. If a computer-controlled car breaks a traffic law, who gets the ticket? Who is responsible if the technology messes up and someone gets hurt or killed? And how might this impact Florida's future highway needs? That's why St. Petersburg Republican Representative Jeff Brandis filed his bill.
What this bill actually does is just allows the technology to be tested and requires that the state of Florida in 2 years issue a report and regulations, the recommended report and regulations for this type of technology.
Diane Carr with the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers had some reservations.
We're saying more appropriately that the regulator would be at the federal level to establish one standard that would govern throughout the 50 states how it is that autonomous driving would operate.
But committee member Clay Ford, a Republican from Pensacola, gave Brandis props for thinking ahead.
When I first read your bill, I thought, you know, what is he thinking? You know, this it sounds so off the wall. But so many times we have technologies that come down the pike, and the laws are behind and don't allow us to fully take advantage of those technologies when they're available.
Some other members of the committee hope there might also be a chance for Florida to attract autonomous vehicle research to the state by having the appropriate road rules in place. That would seem to position the bill perfectly for its next stop in the House Transportation and Economic Development Appropriations Committee. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Tom Flanagan.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are James Call, Sasha Cordner, Tom Flanagan, Lynn Hatter, and Regan McCarthy. Thanks also to the contributing stations along the Florida Public Radio Network. Taylor Cox provides technical assistance for Capitol Report, and I'm Tramell Gomes, inviting you to join us each weeknight for more reports from the state capitol.